Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. It's my pleasure to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's also my pleasure to introduce Ace Smith, who's a political consultant and lifelong baseball fanatic, and he has written his first book called The Pitcher and the Dictator on Satchel Paige's Unlikely Season in the Dominican Republic. It's just such an interesting, fascinating story about the reality of what happened where politics met with baseball. And we've had a couple of those before on Lefty O'Doul and how baseball got to Japan and how that was part of that. So here's another element of how baseball has entered the political realm in addition to everything else that baseball does for America. Thanks a lot for coming, Ace.
Thank you so much, all my friends, for coming here tonight. Just really, really appreciate it. Let me just start and kind of say how I end up writing this book to begin with. Everyone who lives here in San Francisco will appreciate it greatly, which is that in 2005, I just run the campaign for a guy named Antonio Villaraigosa for mayor of L.A. And that was a really tough race, and I was kind of back already, and we'd won the race, and it was the summer of 05, and I was just goofing around. And the way I goof around is I read a lot of books. And that particular summer, I had my office was in North Beach, and so I would wander down to City Lights Books, and I would just buy, you know, a few books every week. And just by happenstance, I bought a book. It's called The Feast of the Goat. And if you haven't read it, get it. It's a wonderful book by Mario Vargas Llosa, the great Peruvian author. And it's about, you know, essentially the assassination of Rafael Trujillo with, you know, CIA weapons in 1961. And then just by pure luck, the next book I grabbed off the shelves there was a book called Satchel Paige's America. And in that book, it's a funny book. It was written by a sports writer from the 1960s who was at the end of his life. And he had written a kind of like a series of, you know, like in the old days when they had 3- and 5-part series, we don't have those things anymore, on Paige. And he had spent a huge amount of time with Paige in Kansas City. And essentially his book was, he had just reams of notebooks, and he just kind of published them. He put some periods and commas and things in them. But it's really Satchel Paige's story. And in this story, Satchel tells the story of the 1937 Dominican series. And I read that after having read this book about Trujillo, and I was just fascinated. I was transfixed by this whole notion. And so I kind of wanted to get to the bottom of it because I thought there was way more to it than just what Satchel had said. And so I looked around, and I finally found, after a little bit of time, that the University of Santa Barbara, UC Santa Barbara, actually had the 1937 papers from the Dominican Republic. So I got in my car, and I motored down the 101 some weekend, and I read them through cover to cover. And I realized that the story itself was so much more fascinating than anyone ever told it. And I dug up all the accounts, and we'll get to what was missing in a minute. But essentially, the accounts that existed, which were no longer than, say, a page or two, were kind of the accounts that the American players wrote after their experience. And they were literally just seeing maybe 10% of what was happening. And so the way I wrote this book was as a kind of a parallel lives, because I always tell people this about the book, which is that it's not really you don't have to love baseball to enjoy this book. It's really a book about race, politics, and baseball. And frankly, baseball's the excuse to tell the story about what was going on, and what was going on in America at the time, what was going on in international relations with Southern American and Caribbean countries, and how it all kind of fit together in a really kind of fascinating, sometimes very tragic way. So I decided to write a parallel history of these two people. And so let me just kind of talk about them just very briefly, and then we'll get to how they came together. Satchel Paige is probably, you know, I believe one of the great sports figures of the last, you know, 100 years or so. I mean, here's a man who he had the kind of maybe the fortune or the misfortune of living in the days before television. So people really didn't see what he could do. And of course, we all remember he was banned from playing baseball because of his race. And so he wasn't able to play baseball until he was 42 years old. And even then, what he did in the major leagues was extraordinary. And to get a kind of like to get your you know idea of who this man is, you have to ask yourself a very simple question. And we hear, you know, every day you read the sports page or you listen to the hype on radio and TV about the things players have overcome. And they tend to be, you know, Achilles, you know, tendon pulls or this or that or the other thing. But what Satchel overcame is truly remarkable. Satchel is born. He's born Leroy Page in Mobile, Alabama. He's born in 1906. And in that first decade in that time, it's literally about maybe 15 years away from when the Confederacy, the old Confederate troops, you know, essentially seized the governments of all the southern states. And they radically segregated everything, created an apartheid state. And in the first decade of his life, his least concern was about being discriminated against. It was much more concerning about possibly being lynched. I mean, lynchings were so rampant in Mobile, Alabama in that first decade of his life that even some of the upright citizens were outraged that they did one of them in front of the downtown church. I mean, and that's just how horrible and, and blatant. And really in semi-legal it all was. Here's a guy when he was 6 years old. He's living in such abject poverty that his mother takes him aside and he says, you know, son, you gotta go get a job. And Satchel, he says he felt like he was 64 years old. And so what he did, and this kind of tells you about the brilliance of him, so Leroy decides the way he's going to make money is he's going to carry bags from the train station to the downtown. And so he starts doing this, and he's charging 10 cents a bag. And he's clever, and he figures out very quickly that 2 bags, 20 cents, 3 bags, 30 cents, so on and so forth, does the math. And before long, he has this huge long pole, and it's got strings and attachments and stuff on it. And this little kid, he's carrying like 10 bags. And so he's making a buck a trip, which is real money, you know, 1912 in Mobile, Alabama. And all the kids, they start giving him a hard time, and they start calling him Satchel because they thought he was a walking satchel tree. And Satchel, Leroy, is smart. He knew a good nickname when he heard one. And he grabbed that nickname for the rest of his life. At age 12... Satchel, one day is in the downtown part of Mobile, Alabama, and he of course can't afford anything, and he grabs a little handful of brass rings, and of course he gets caught, and he can't understand, why when his mother comes down to the police station get him, she's so upset, and because he thinks she's going to be really mad at me, and you know this will blow over or whatever. Well, it turns out the mother is upset because she realizes what's going to really happen to him, which is that he's going to be incarcerated, and literally incarcerated from the time he's 12 to 18. It's amazing. But the thing about his incarceration at the Home for Negro Lawbreakers near Montgomery, near the Capitol, is that this is where he decides to that he's going to become a great pitcher. And so there happens to be a coach there, but he kind of figures everything on his own. And so he really he hones his talent, and he dedicates his time to becoming a great pitcher. So when he finally gets out at age 18, he's back in Mobile, Alabama. And he happens to be very lucky because there's a guy, you all probably remember the Alexis Herman, who Bill Clinton's labor secretary. Alexis Herman's father was a guy named Alex Herman, who lived in Mobile, Alabama at the time and actually was the manager and part owner of the Chattanooga Negro League team. So he saw Satchel pitch, and he grabbed him. And the thing that's crazy about Satchel, and one of the things I did was I traced back to the very first game he ever played. And what's remarkable is that from that very first game, he's just a head and shoulders above everyone else, just a star. It's just they marvel at the incredible curves of the lengthy colored speedball pitcher, Satchel Paige. And he never, he becomes, of course, a great star in the Negro Leagues. But of course, he's only relegated to playing for, a very small part of the population and for very, very little money. Rafael Trujillo. Rafael Trujillo is kind of another interesting parallel story. Here's a guy who, kind of like Satchel, wouldn't have had a chance in the world to succeed. In his case, the reason why he succeeds in a very evil way is because the Americans, we invade the Dominican Republic. And why do we invade the Dominican Republic in 1916? Because they owe Wall Street money. So we invade them. We shut down the government. We close down their newspapers. We seize every firearm in the, I hate to tell NRA people this, they seized 3 million firearms and literally dumped them in the Caribbean, and ran the whole country into martial law. So what did they need? What did they need? They needed what we do still today in Afghanistan and Iraq, all these other places. They needed to build a force of native-grown people, police people. So who did they sign up? They signed up this guy, Rafael Trujillo, who was a security guard, basically a thug, at the sugar plantations to keep all the Haitians in line. And so Trujillo gets that assignment. He literally climbs all the way up the ladder of opportunity to become the head of essentially the American forces, which then when we finally allow them to have free elections in 1924, he talks the president, who he's become chummy with, into actually making it into a national army. Of course, he's the head of the national army. And then he bides his time and he waits for 1930. And he sees some weakness in President Vasquez. And he essentially runs a bloodless coup d'etat. And he does it by, he gets this other kind of really clueless politician from the Santiago area who he talks into going into, halvesies on this thing. And the poor guy thinks he's going to be president. And Trujillo does a little switcheroo and says, I'm actually going to be president. You're going to be my vice president. They rig the election. He wins. Okay, so we get to 1937. And Trujillo is running for re-election in 1938, as much as dictators run for re-election, right? And his people are essentially convince him that what he needs to do, kind of like the equivalent of, say, Roman games, we're going to do something great for the population in return for your liberty. And so they create this series. And I literally, because no one would believe me, I actually put a picture of it in the book. So they create a series, literally, and it's called National Championship Dedicated to the Re-election of President Trujillo. There's the series. Okay, so there's three teams in the series. There's the team from what we know as Santo Domingo, but which has now been renamed Ciudad Trujillo, Trujillo City, which is Trujillo's team, obviously, Trujillo Dragones, and then a team from San Pedro de Macorís down the coast and a team from Santiago. Well, all of his people, they've talked him into it. They've said, President, this is going to be great. You're going to go up in the esteem of the people. The series starts. A little minor problem. The Trujillo's team starts losing because the other teams have better players. They have imported a bunch of Cubans and Puerto Ricans. And so the poor guy who's running the team, wakes up one day and he must have just decided, this is not just going to be bad in my resume. I'm going to get shot here. this is not a good thing. So what does he do to solve the problem? He decides that the only way to solve the problem is to go to America and recruit the best players available, and probably the best players who ever played baseball were the Negro League players. So imagine, so Satchel, this is the spring of 1937. He's wandering down the main street of New Orleans, and out of nowhere comes this short little man with a white suit and a white hat with a black band, and he introduces himself to Satchel. He says, "I'd like to introduce myself. I'm Dr. Jose Enrique Ibar. I work for President Trujillo of the Dominican Republic, and the president would like to retain your services." And Satchel recounts, he says, first of all, he says, "I thought, well, this must be one hell of a sick ball club if they got a doctor in charge." That's the first thing he thinks. But he doesn't say that. But what he says is, he says, basically, maybe the first time in sports, he says, "Show me the money." So the guy, they agree to meet the next day. And the little doctor shows up with a bank book. And in the bank book, on the ledger line, it says Satchel Paige, and below it says $30,000, which is probably something like, five times the amount of money he had made in his entire career up to that point. And so Satchel says, "Hell yeah!" And he says, "The only thing you have to do is you have to bring my trusty catcher with me, and we're all fine." So Satchel, the good doctor, and the catcher get in one of those old seaplanes that you've seen, and they take off, and they land down by San Pedro de Macarís, and they get rolling. And what Satchel does beyond just pitching and making the team better is Satchel starts recruiting all of his other fellow players, and they literally just raid the Negro Leagues of all the top talent. And by the time they're done with this thing, I would actually say, I think probably maybe the best baseball players who ever played probably played in this series. I mean, among others were, aside from Satchel, Cool Papa Bell, who was probably the quickest player. Louis Tiant's father played in this. Perucho Cepeda, Orlando Cepeda's father, played in this series. The greatest power-hitting catcher ever played in this series. There was just an amazing amount of talent. All in the series, but there was a little bit of a catch here. So the catch is this. And this is the story that was never really told, is they get down there, and these players, these Negro League players, they're used to playing in those days almost like every day or maybe every other day, traveling. And it's just the way you make your money, because in between league games, you would play other games, and at the end of the season, you'd have to, no one was paying you during the off season. You had to fill in with barnstorming and everything else. So they get down there and they realize that all they got to do is play on the weekends and goof off the rest of the time. And the other thing that's a kind of quite a revelation to them is they're these young black players, right? And they're down there, and they're used to like everywhere in the United States. Right, United States of America. Well, guess what? There's a little bit in one of the most like repressive dictatorships in the world, but in some sense for them, there's more freedom. And why is there more freedom? They can go to any bar, brothel, dance club, you name it, golf course, and there's no signs up that say no coloreds. And plus they got money. So they party up a storm. And there's a little catch. They start losing games. So what does Trujillo do? And this is one of the great ironies of ironies, is Trujillo ran his newspapers, kind of like Stalin ran his newspapers, which is, it was like essentially whatever he wanted on the front page in the newspaper, half of the stuff was stuff that he wrote or ordered written. And so the most, probably, and the other little weird thing about Dominican Republic at that time, anytime a big scoop would run, they would actually blow the air raid sirens. And probably when they blew the air raid sirens, probably about, half dozen people had heart attacks, because what happened was, if you were denounced in the papers, like you were like the best case for you is your career's done. Probably more likely you're going to jail, and maybe even more likely than that, you're probably going to get shot. And so these denunciations, and it's interesting when you read through the papers, it's frightening. It seemed like in the papers I was scanning, there'd be kind of a major denunciation of someone. Like, it seemed like every, somewhere between 3 weeks and a month or so. And Trujillo, of course, and his people found out what was going on. And so there's a full-throated denunciation of all the black players. It says, they're going to bars, they're falling down drunk, they're in the bordellos every night, they're not showing up to practice, the whole nine yards. I'm convinced to this day that one of the great ironies, I don't think the players ever knew that even happened. They didn't have a clue. But what they did know happened. So because they weren't, Trujillo wasn't going to shoot them or put them on trial, right? But what did happen was this. Trujillo took the head of his Gestapo, a guy named Miguel Angel Polino, and he put Mr. Polino, installed him as the assistant manager of the team. And it was called the assistant manager in charge of discipline. And Paulino did two things. He, first of all, he went to every bar and bordello and dance hall, and he said, you serve these guys drinks, you're dead. And then he put kind of guards around where the players were staying to make sure they weren't carousing, and told them very directly, like, you win or else, kind of laying them, and the sentence themselves. And so with the enforced new measures of discipline, they actually, they get back on a winning streak. As a matter of fact, Satchel won almost all of his games. He had a rough start from that point on. And they actually get to the very last game, and they the pitcher who's in there for his team is faltering horribly. And Satchel has to come in and relieve him. And Satchel recounts that as he's pitching, he recounts two things. He says, first of all, I knew the umpires saw the guns in the stands of all Trujillo's troops, and so he said, I had a pretty wide strike zone. and he said the other thing was that he was so, it may be the only time, because he was a cool customer, he was like the only time in his life he was genuinely freaked out, and that he could hardly even, throw a pitch. But he they actually almost load the bases and almost win the game, but he pulls out in the very end. And then I'll let you read the book to find out the rest of what happens. And what I do in the book is I take the stories of their lives. It's like the series of the 37 series is really just, as I said, an excuse to tell the stories of their lives. So the book takes you through essentially the story of Satchel Paige's life from the beginning all the way to the end. It takes you through the story of his struggles with in the major leagues, where when he goes in the major leagues at 42 years old, he has a thing called a hesitation pitch. And he was so embarrassing, and it's a perfectly legal pitch. He was so embarrassing the major league hitters with his windup that they out of nowhere, they just outlaw it. So this is what he was up against. I tell his story all the way through. And I tell the story of Trujillo all the way through. And the other notable people that you might not have heard of in the book, and there's a reason why you wouldn't, is there's a great Cuban player who was named Martin Diego. Diego is probably the greatest. First of all, there's no player who's in more Hall of Fames than Diego. He's in the American Hall of Fame, Venezuelan, Cuban, Dominican, and I'm probably missing one, Venezuelan, I think. There is no player who was probably, he hit for power, hit for average. He played every position but catcher. He started as a dominant power hitter. He actually ended up as a dominant pitcher. was really one of the really remarkable players to ever play baseball. Well, why don't you hear about him? It's a minor little detail. It has to do with international relations. He left Cuba, very much like, you know, as Pablo Casals left Spain, because of the dictatorship at the time. And he left and he lived in exile in Mexico. And in Mexico, he actually raised money for Castro. And so when Castro took power, Diego came over and became his minister of sports. And so, of course, anyone associated with the Castro administration, by and large, was, kind of dead to American sports and American sports writers and American history, for that matter. So the only book that's been written on probably one of those extraordinary athletes who ever played baseball is actually a very slim little volume printed in Havana, and that's it. But again, someone worth getting to know, and I write a chapter on him.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
The last thing I would just kind of talk about briefly, and then we'll do questions, is one of the fun things is I wondered, how did this guy, Satchel Paige, how did he pitch for so long, and how did he pitch so effectively? Because what he did is unheard of. And, there must have been something to it, because pitchers in today's games, you can't, if you have a 10-year career, that's probably 15 years, that's probably about as good as it will ever get, and you're going to wear down. So how did this guy pitch all these games, pitch so effectively over such a huge amount of time? And there's two kind of main witnesses about this, and they happen to be probably two of the greatest hitters in modern history, Ted Williams and Willie Mays, who testify to what I'm going to tell you. And part of it is from a book that was written by a Chicago sports writer and features guy in the 1940s, who interviewed Satchel and said, kind of, tell me your secret sauce. Mm-hmm. And here's what it is, and it's kind of fascinating. So what Satchel figured out was okay, how do I pitch 9 innings and not blow out my arm and become a wreck like everyone else? So what he did was he would pitch from 3 different arm slots. He pitched like 3/4, sidearm, and submarine. And he would literally split the game, and he would like pitch a third of the game one way, a third this way. And he figured very brilliantly that actually by doing it, what he recounts is that he was able to actually kind of take the stress and distribute it over different muscle groups over the course of the game, so he's not wrecking everything. That was the first thing he did, and which is probably the reason for his longevity. And if you think about it too logically, it's like if you're the hitter, and this is what Ted Williams and Willie Mays talk about, like if you're hitting against someone and they're coming at you at different angles during the game, that's really tough because it's a different look every time. The other thing he did, other two things he did, was he did this thing, which again, be coached against, was called walking the rubber. So we all know what the pitching rubber is, like a little rectangular thing. And what he would do is every pitch, he would stand at a different location on it. And again, just to alter the angle of the pitch. And he was very random about it. And the third thing he did, again, very much along the same lines, so Satchel was a wonderful musician. And so he understood tempo and beat. And he figured that if you messed up the hitter's tempo, his timing, you won half the game. And so Satchel had just say, instead of, again, most pitchers maybe have one or two windups most, he had like 30. And he would vary. He had everything from like a windmill to a step-in pitch to a famous hesitation pitch and everything in between. Again, on the theory that if you mess up the timing, you've won half the battle. And so when you face Satchel, not only did you face someone with wicked pitches and great control, like many people in the major leagues today have, you face someone who was coming at you on all these different angles from all these different arm slots and messing with your timing. So good luck on that. And and that's why, you know, he pitched exhibition games into his 50s and was effective. And that's why he was, you know, and so he was truly, and one of the things that was kind of fun was Ted Williams, who testifies to what a great pitcher Satchel was. And Ted Williams says what made Satchel Paige great was that you never knew he changed the look every time. And that's how you mess someone up. And Ted talks about how he went in the, I think it was in the late 30s, as a teenager, he saved up his money to go see Satchel Paige pitch in San Diego. And I spent the time to go find the game. And indeed, it was a game where Satchel, he was actually a benefit game. And he struck out, I think it was like 15 or 17 hitters. And that's the first time that Williams saw him. Then Williams also faced him later. But the thing that kind of amazed me was we live in this era where all the stats and everything, they all seem so magical and all perfect. Well, so when I went back to reconstruct that game and many of the other games, I was always scratching my head because a lot of times the box scores in those days actually don't agree with each other. And so like one box score from one newspaper had him striking out 15, another one I think 17, and another one maybe 19. And same with the Dominican box scores because everyone was keeping score differently and it wasn't all automated and wonderful. And, so there's a lot of disagreement on all this. At this point, I would love to take any questions anyone has and on any topic whatsoever.
So who would like to ask the first question? Someone over here, yeah.
What do you want people to take away from your book? Having read it, what do you hope they learn or feel or do?
I want them to take away, one of the things that was eye-opening to me, two things, was I was trying to reconstruct some of these scenes. And so, like, for instance, when Satchel is in New Orleans in April 1937, I grabbed every local newspaper I could get for months, and I read them all. I grabbed all the, and one of the things that was kind of interesting was all the black newspapers at that time, which are Chicago Defender, Pittsburgh Courier, the New Amsterdam Times, but the whole series of them were actually national newspapers, which and so a lot of them were mailed all the way into the Deep South, and that's the way a lot of the black populace got their news and tracked down all those. And the thing that was stunning to me was the, just trying to read through the history, like you stumble across lynching after lynching. And it's just, you know, so you ask, you know, why would he get up and leave? It's like, why wouldn't you? But the accounts are just harrowing and heartbreaking. The other thing that you grow up reading American or learning American history in American classrooms, and maybe I had, you know, different history books than everyone else, but I never knew that we invaded all these countries, and I never knew that we invaded Nicaragua in 1912, Haiti in 1915, Dominican Republic in 1916, not to mention all the incursions in Mexico with Pershing and whatnot, and. Not only did we invade these countries, we invaded them because essentially they owed Wall Street money. And when we went into these countries, we literally stripped away all their liberties. We shut down their governments, and we put in place martial law. And you don't read about that when you read maybe read about the Spanish-American War and some other things. But it's a whole chapter of history that's completely skipped over. And in the case of the Dominican Republic, what's especially tragic is not only did we essentially kind of lay the groundwork and put in place Trujillo, who was just a tragic dictatorship from 1930 to 1961, when they actually got freedom again and had free elections and elected Juan Bosch, we supported essentially all the displaced Trujillo people who put in place Joaquin Balaguer, who essentially was like a Trujillo person for another 20 years. So, you know, you wonder why there's animosity in different parts of the world and stuff you don't quite read about.
It's interesting you mentioned the 1915, 1916. That's Woodrow Wilson's presidency. Was he involved or was it somebody else? I mean, because
he was calling the shots, yeah.
Because it seems so opposed to what he did after World War One. So,
no, Wilson was.
What's the background on that?
Well, the background is Wilson was incredibly aggressive in foreign, especially in Western Hemisphere. Remember, he sent Pershing into Mexico. Because there were some incursions across the border. It's interesting when you read that part of Dominican history, you realize that folks in Dominican Republic in 1915 were incredibly nervous about their future because of what had just happened in Haiti. Part of history that gets skipped over, you don't read about, but we did it and we did it for a number of years. As a matter of fact, it really only got shut down in the 20s. When Congress holds a series of hearings and they actually start exposing some of the atrocities in the villages and other things that were going on and Americans got embarrassed enough that we actually got out and allowed free elections.
Hmm. Next question.
Did Satchel ever express any opinions about the political situation in Dominican? And also, did he ever meet Trujillo in person?
That's a great question. He recounts is he got down there and he realized, one little piece of background about Satchel is, so in order for not just Satchel, but any of the Negro League players to make ends meet, they were actually quite internationalists. I mean, they, to kind of fill in their dance card, make enough money to survive, they played in Cuba, they played in Venezuela, they played in Nicaragua, they played in, you know, DR, Puerto Rico, so on and so forth. And so, you know, they were well aware of a lot of the political situations. And when he writes about it, he just talks about, you know, it was really clear there's this huge boss. He runs everything. He calls all the shots. And, you know, if you didn't do it, you might be in a heap of trouble. So he got it. Now, what they didn't quite understand was they didn't understand I don't think they understood the background of the whole thing. They didn't understand that the thing was for the guy's reelection and they couldn't lose. They didn't understand that they were denounced in the newspapers. They didn't understand, a lot of the complexities, but they knew they were playing for a strong man.
You said that they weren't aware of the denouncement in the paper, but the paper was obviously not in English. Did any of them read Spanish or any of the players or?
I think they kind of dealt in pocho español, you know, which is kind of like, you know, good enough to order a restaurant, you know, cerveza and, you know.
Next question.
I love the history and the international relations, but as a mother of a young 6'4 lefty pitcher, I'm curious about, you talked about how he altered his delivery, not just to outsmart the batter, but also to protect his arm. Do you think there's a story here for current pitchers?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that's why I wrote this. And actually, I got very lucky. The guy who's like the data kid for the Washington Nationals I made sure to put it in his hand, but he was actually the person who, this is a kind of a funny story, got me Dusty Baker. Mm-hmm. And who was at the time, you know, this is before Dusty had been fired, but it was funny. So I I've talked to him about it a long time and he's like, you'd be, you know, it's a very interesting theory and I hope maybe some folks will look into it. But, the story about Dusty is interesting in the sense that when you do these things, you kind of pre-write all this stuff and then you get people to sign their names to it. Right. So I pre-wrote this really nice thing for Dusty and he actually sent me back, this, which I had no idea. And which he says, I was 19 years old when I played with Satchel Paige in 1968. He knew my name, but he called me Daffy. And I was happy to let him. By then, Satchel had lived one of the most extraordinary lives of our time. And it was interesting, the influence, because Satchel went around and was really, he was almost like a, like a sandlot prophet, and he went everywhere trying to teach young people how to play. And to my great astonishment, Dusty, otherwise known as Daffy, had come across him.
You said trial. Did he learn this by trial and error, or did he have a theory? Do you have any idea how he developed this way to protect his body? Because
I think he was a brilliant man. Mm-hmm. I mean, just look at how he did the satchels. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a really brilliant man who just figured out every angle better than other folks. And plus, he wasn't steeped in all the conventional wisdom. He wasn't mm-hmm. taught by all the people who were teaching the same thing they were teaching everyone else. So he could really do it. And the other thing too, that's worth understanding is Negro League baseball is so radically different than the form of baseball we're used to today. So think more like the NBA. Mm-hmm. So just to give you two examples, Satchel's catcher had a chest protector, a white chest protector. And he had someone letter in, you know, kind of like that fake old fashioned, you know, ye old tavern type writing on it. And it said, "Thou shall not steal." Now, I guarantee you that would not fly in Major League Baseball today. One of the first basemen on one of the teams, a guy named Dave Showboat Thomas, he was famous for his signature move, which was in an inning ending double play or a rally killer, he would take that ended with the last play at first base, he would take the throw behind his back. Again, and if you read the accounts again and again and again, you find out that when these Negro League players end up in the major leagues, they were like, wow, that's easy, because they realized that the play was so much less aggressive, so much not nearly as quick, you know, that they actually thought it was the easiest thing they ever did.
Did any white players go also to play? Because I know sometimes they did play with the Negro League players to make more money.
Well, there would be a bunch of Cubans who you know, we might consider white, and probably some Dominicans, but, like there was a guy, Silvio Lopez, who was a Cuban, and, But there were no white major leaguers. But Lopez is kind of an interesting, or Silvio Garcia, interesting guy. He is actually he was one of the people that when Branch Rickey was looking at integrating the Dodgers and bringing Jackie Robinson, he interviewed a number of players and he interviewed Silvio. And he brought Silvio in and he said, "Hey, Silvio, I'm just trying to figure this out here, Silvio, but if someone like hurls a racial epithet at you, like, how are you going to react?" He says, "Oh, I killed the man." So of course he didn't get the job, but there were probably, a number of Puerto Ricans and no like mainstream.
And also the other question is, you know, my favorite players growing up here were Latin. We had a lot of Latin players from those countries, Juan Marichal. And then you mentioned Cepeda. So I was kind of curious about, so do you think some of these guys were influenced by seeing these barnstorming teams to then play? Because, you know, we had great players in the late 50s coming from there.
Oh, no question. I mean, yeah, I mean, let's take Orlando Cepeda. Orlando Cepeda, his father was Perucho Cepeda, and was considered by all the people who saw him a better all-round player, better all-round hitter than the son. But of course, he wouldn't have been allowed to play Major League Baseball. Louis Tian's father, he was known as Sir Skinny. He was an incredibly crafty left-handed pitcher. His very famous son, you know, pitched in that very famous series for the Boston Red Sox. And so on and so forth. Many of these players were parents of players who were later in the major league. So, you know, and all of these players like Marichal and the Puerto Rican players all grew up playing with these players and revering them and playing the style of play. which is frankly, if you know, it's kind of like, did you play in the minor leagues? It was like, no, you actually played in a league that was probably tougher than the league, than the major leagues.
Could you just talk a little bit about the hesitation pitch where some major league players wanted it outlawed? Did it, was it described anywhere in your research what that would look like?
Yeah, there's
it's in the book then.
There's a full description of the hesitation pitch, which by Willie Mays, which is in the appendix. And Willie described it as this crazy wind up, and before you knew it, you didn't think anything was going on, and the pitch would be on you, wham. and that's how Willie described it, and I'm sure Willie played against Satchel down the South, but you'll see that I devote a little bit of time to the fact that it is literally within about a month of him getting in the major leagues that the American League president just literally by fiat outlaws the pitch, and with no explanation. Of course, he's not going to admit the real reason, but you know, I'm sure he had some technical reason, but the real reason was that he was embarrassing hitters.
Any insights that you would like to share about how Satchel lived out his post-baseball years or his final days? Was it a good life? How was it?
Oh, it was a great life, because he was, unlike, you know, you watch too many retired athletes who they get past their glory days and they still think they're in their glory days. And Satchel was just he was an incredibly gregarious people person. He would just love people. And so he to the end of his life, he would just, you know, almost like drive around the country. And, you know, and the Dusty Baker thing is a great example. And just help young kids who are learning to play baseball, who are breaking in. And he just so loved the game that he would just, and he was one of these people, he talks about how his first marriage broke up. And the reason is because, you know, he was one of these people who just could never stay put for a minute. And that wasn't so good with the first marriage, but he worked out the second time. But he was a guy always on the move, always loving people, and was just really a prophet for baseball the rest of his life. But he also pitched. I want to say he pitched a exhibition game for like an inning for Charlie Finley, I think in, I want to say, 1965. So he was, you know.
Yeah, you said that he joined Major League Baseball when he was 42.
Yep.
Did he pitch full time for many seasons, right? I mean,
well, in the majors, he pitched for the Cleveland Indians. They won the World Series that year. Mm-hmm. Then he pitched for Bill Veeck's other team, St. Louis Browns, and then he pitched for a number of exhibitions and whatnot after that.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And so ends another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 116th year of enlightened discussion.